This episode is dedicated to the memory of Ben Daglish, who sadly passed away during its production. Except for a new closing section, this episode is otherwise presented as originally written. Owning a home computer in 2018 is so common and ubiquitous that even the phrase home computer sounds antiquated. Today, it's less about if you own one and more a question of how many and how powerful. Just 5 decades ago, a home computer was considered a luxury and usually left to the obsessive hands of hobbyists. Like the gaming PCs of our modern era, most models would have to be self-assembled, until the 1980s brought a flood of commercially available units to the market. Arguably chief among these was the Commodore 64. Even by the standards of its time, it was far from the most powerful computer, but its clever design and marketing made programming vastly accessible. Of course, the majority of C64 software consisted of video games, rudimentary shoot-em-ups, proto-RPGs, ancestral platformers, and even online titles. The range of C64 games is as vibrant as the PlayStation's or Nintendo's, and paved the way for the gigantic AAA releases that dominate our consoles. Across this series, this podcast has aimed to expose and detail the importance of video game music. The C64 and its ilk succinctly make my point for me. All these years on, the innovative work of composers and the sounds they achieved with the SID chip alone are probably better known than the games they scored. A whole contemporary genre, chiptune, exists purely to carry the torch of musicians like Rob Hubbard, Ben Daglish, Matt Gray, Tim Follin, and a continuing list too long to truly complete. Besides an ongoing interest in chiptune, their legacy lives on through popular live performances, like Back in Time, and even orchestral arrangements. C64 music has been explored in focused books, and given spotlight through wonderful documentaries like From Bedrooms to Billions. Though I was born 8 years after the first introduction of the Commodore 64, it's impossible to avoid its influence, and players like myself still sample its magic through emulators and the archives of enthusiasts. I'm Lee Tyrrell, and this is The Sound Test, where I look in-depth into video game audio and music, along with the very people who crafted it. For this episode, I consider it an honour to have spoken to both Rob Hubbard and Ben Daglish, two of the C64's most well-regarded composers. Over the course of this podcast, you'll hear them discuss some of their key tracks, the circumstances surrounding them, and how they came to be. Many of this podcast's listeners may already be familiar with the intricacies of the C64, but for those who aren't, Ben, Rob and I take some time to cover the fundamentals. After all, any C64 owner could produce simple music from their machine by following the user manual. You can find a link to that exact manual in the description, which outlines how to set up a single voice and melody, almost like an old monophonic ringtone. However, this was more of a toy and a way to get instant gratification from relatively simple programming. In order to incorporate polyphonic music into actual games, where two sounds can play at once, you'd need something far more complex.
So the player in the manual, as it were, I believe was in Commodore Basic. It was just basically a thing to take a bunch of notes and poke them into the right memory locations, and then a simple loop to read the data and play it. which kind of, it worked as a standalone player, but obviously wouldn't work as a bit of code that a programmer could incorporate into their game. It's quite difficult to explain unless you're a programmer, but I'm sure half of the people that are listening to this are going to be programmers anyway. I think the basic player just kind of, you had a, it set up a single sound for you, right? And that was it, you know, and maybe even kind of just a single voice. I can't remember. But so you need something that's going to be, yeah, able to mess around with all the parameters of the sound kind of on the fly, and have a data format that's sufficiently rich enough that it can express sounds and notes and sequences and changes to parameters. You can kind of, in the middle of playing a sequence, you can go play the sequence again but with a different filter parameter or something. So a lot more complex than the basic examples on how to play notes on your Amstrad CPC or whatever.
Video games, from the 1980s to modern home consoles and PCs, utilize a game loop to update the game state. It checks, at a rate faster than human perception, for user inputs, controls AI, and constantly attends to the ever-changing graphics and sound. In this context, the music player provided in the user manual is useless. So how was audio weaved into the game loops of the C64?
So you need kind of a single standalone bit of assembly language that the programmer can go as part of his game loop. You know, he goes, the game loop goes, read the inputs, redraw the graphics, play a bit of the music, and update the game state to move the player to here. Right, then go around again, read the inputs, update the graphics, update the music. So the main loop kind of calls the player every, whatever it was, 25th of a second or something. And so the player, every 25th of a second, had to go, right, play the next thing, play the next thing, play the next thing of whatever's in its data queue.
Even a sprawling, dense game like GTA 5 runs a game loop in the background. The principle is the same as it was in the 80s, only expanded beyond recognition. Music is just one part of a game loop, but that single area encompasses the actual notes being played, the order they're played in, and the voice the notes would use, or, to put it another way, the instrument. When you look at the largely dynamic soundtracks of games like GTA 5, it's easy to see how complicated the process has become. Game loops for the C64 were, through necessity, more streamlined, but SID chip composers were determined to stretch capabilities with every new line of code.
The code itself, or the data for the code itself, consisted of, you'd have a bunch of bars of music, as it were, a bunch of bars that defined the notes themselves. And then you'd have like the sequence of it that said, you know, play bar one, then bar two, then play bar one again, then play bar three, then play bar eight 10 times, and then play bars four and six each twice over. Or, you know, do you know what I mean? And also within that as well, it would be play bar one. Now play bar one on a different voice with a different instrument. So you'd use as much of your material in as many different ways as you could.
C64 musicians utilise tricks of a sort to make the most of ludicrously small memory space. The right minor adjustment could reframe an existing melody as something else entirely. In an environment where every stray bit mattered, such methods became par for the course. To create something more engaging than a short ditty, you'd have to get inventive.
Swapping instruments, or taking one pattern and, well, not generally going as far as reversing it, but playing sequences on top of each other. So you kind of have a bass line that would be your main bass line for your first part, and then you could use that bass line again, but shifted up by a fourth for a completely different part or something, you know. And so, yes, that was how you could get the most sort of notes for your buck, as it were. Because defining notes is expensive. So if you can get away with having as few notes defined, but then you're using those and making it sound like they're different, it's clever sequencing. That's what it comes down to.
The very best C64 composers, like Ben and Rob Hubbard, could trick the minds of listeners as much as they could the SID chip itself. The chip was able to play three channels of audio simultaneously. To put this in perspective, that meant a game running both music and sound effects could only play two different monophonic instruments at the same times in effect. That's equivalent to stamping your foot while playing a two-stringed guitar. Put in those terms, it's all the more amazing to hear the depth of quality C64 music. Almost hypnotic, incredibly deliberate composing can actually convince players' minds that once present rhythms and harmonies are still a part of the mix.
The trick is to, if you start something musically and then introduce another element, you can then sort of almost like take that first element away, and subconsciously you've got used to hearing it, your brain will somehow fill in the blanks even though it's not there. That happens quite a lot, and you will actually notice that it's not there. Even though in reality it might be completely removed or it might be partially removed, but your brain still thinks it's still there and fills in the blanks. I mean, that's something that I knew about and I used to do quite a lot.
Another method for stretching three voices as far as possible was so widely used that it became a basic element of almost all C64 tunes. It's best heard in the interplay between bass lines and drum patterns. The bass, which plays defined notes and acts as its own instrument, is also used as a kick drum. That way, bass notes can alternate with snare and hi-hat sounds on the same single voice, giving music programmers two instruments for one.
Rob was the master of this. I mean, he was saying a little while ago to me that he'd keep going back and through every single bar that he got, finding any single little bit of space, like a new semiquaver somewhere, that he could just slap in, say, a clave or something, you know. The classic example being, I mean, you know, like the whole the bass and the drums on the same channel, and you can kind of make that sound like it's two separate voices. If you define your bass sound so it's got a bit of the bottom thud in it as well, so it sounds like a bass drum. So it sounds like you've got a drum pattern going. And that kind of stuff has been, there's a piece by, is it Bach? or there's a few pieces around that do that with kind of having two alternating lines, and it sounds like two different melodies coming out.
Behind the scenes of any actual music playing, the code that generated it needed just as much attention to stay efficient. Composers usually worked out their own individual approaches to achieve that. Some would even make use of self-modifying code to really tighten up functions. Sequencing could be a far easier task if handled properly, potentially avoiding lines of bulky, unnecessary code. In what ways would Rob, a true master of the SID chip, save space beyond what we hear as players?
Well, for me, it was a question of I could define a musical phrase and then be able to just index that phrase with a number and then add a sequence of numbers that would then recall the phrases, and I could therefore get a very efficient way of recalling these phrases and transposing them with an extra control bytes. That was the main way that I managed to save space. You would do self-modifying code as well, but that would only just save you odd bits and bytes. The other thing to save space is to, when you've got different bytes which are acting as control registers for certain parameters, pack all the bits completely so that you use every bit that's available to control a function, so that you're not really wasting many bytes or bits.
In some extreme cases, sacrifices would have to be made. Available memory for music and sound depended on the game and the developer's personal taste. If a particular developer thought music was a minor add-on, it was treated as such when allotted space. In that situation, all C64 composers could do was bite the bullet and remove whole routines from the process.
There were a couple of occasions where I had to sometimes squeeze into an insanely small amount of space, and then either I would have to just delete bits of code because they were too bulky. I think that I probably had a couple of vibrato routines, one that was a lot more involved than the other, and so if I had to squeeze something down, I would just get rid of that vibrato routine, or something else had to go in order to squeeze everything in. Also, I had to maybe do 20 or 30 sound effects on these games as well, and so I'd have to think of a way of trying to squeeze that down as well. So it might not have been the music that got squeezed down, but it might have been the sound effects code as well. It's always been a case that, you know, the audio is a bit of an afterthought, and it's always been this thing that gets the least amount of thought and the least amount of, you know, resources and everything else. I don't think it's true today with these, you know, massive PlayStation 4 games. I don't think it's like that now, but, you know, certainly throughout the 80s and 90s it was. You're always fighting to get 10% of the resource and 10% of the budget, if you're lucky.
Concerns about space limitations are largely a thing of the past, and VGM has come to be respected and understood as an important part of the medium. Some developers maintain a certain elitism about music and games, but composers in general don't worry about the file size of their soundtracks. That frees them up to pile on as many effects as they like, onto pieces that can include a full orchestra and more. Any inspiration can be indulged, unlike the penned-in days of the C64. We also have fairly solid ideas on what different genres of games should sound like. For example, bouncy platformers tend to feature playful music to accentuate the fast jumping action. Shooters are known for more dramatic themes, while puzzle games use ambience to help you think of solutions. Most of the gaming genres we enjoy today were brand new in the 80s, so the precedents we take for granted were still finding their feet. With that in mind, what influenced Rob and Ben when working on the title?
I would have a fairly long conversation with the guy who was doing it and trying to get an idea of what was going on. And if I couldn't see it, then I would say questions about what year the game is set in and, the background to it. All these kind of things to try to come up with an idea of what might work. I'm more interested in the animation, how quickly things might have been moving on the screen rather than people's interaction. To me, that was, how fast things might be moving was a bit more relevant.
A lot of the time, you see, it'd be just happenstance, because we didn't get to see the game, or we did, but it would be a few screenshots maybe, or, I mean, even if you got to play it, it would be just for a little bit, you know. Later on, when we were kind of, when I was working for Gremlin or stuff, I was a lot more involved in the initial development of the game, I suppose, but early on, like the very early stuff, you'd just get a phone call saying, could you write me some music for a shoot 'em up? And you'd write what you thought music for a shoot 'em up should be, you know. I don't know necessarily that the genre of the game was initially as important as the theme of the game, the title, the graphics, the speed and technology of the thing, I suppose, as well, you know. In fact, really, genres, it took a little while even for that to be established, if you see what I mean. A game was just a game. It was only kind of a bit later that they started getting labelled platform games or shoot 'em up games or whatever.
Many C64 games required some obvious choices too. For instance, titles like The Last Ninja or International Karate beg for an Eastern flavour. When you have nothing but a title and general concept to work on, certain directions just seem natural. Why write a flashy, up-to-date tune for a game set in the past?
The subject matter, it spurs you on to try to create something musically which reflects the subject matter, and you then have to use your imagination and experience to try to come up with something, which is why some of these games, like the Oriental fighting games, always have that kind of Chinese or Japanese influence, and then the medieval games always have reference to more kind of Renaissance type sounding music.
You know, obviously a lot of it would be influenced by just the title. I mean, classically, you know, like, say, Rob with, like, the Rasputin stuff, or me with Last Ninja, it was kind of, right, I'll write a load of Oriental-sounding music. Or with Rob, it would be, you know, he went off to the, library and got the big book of Russian folk songs and plugged them all together or something, innit?
Since the popularisation of the internet, copyright laws have truly clamped down. Whether that's the right move is a debate for another podcast, but it's intriguing to hear how many recognisable tunes made their way onto the C64. It was a widespread practice too, from almost every SID chip musician. Rob used Russian folk melodies, appropriately, for Rasputin, while one of my favourite examples from Ben is when Jeff Wayne's War of the Worlds pops up in Trap, a game we'll soon explore further. In that wild west of game development, playfully repurposing famous melodies happened often and across the board.
Repurposing? Is that a nice way of saying ripping off? I mean, I've said often, I've been waiting for 35 years for some shaven-headed chaps to knock at the door and go, Jean-Michel Jarre says you owe him some money. For whichever one it was, Locos, I mean, Tony asked me to do Equinox 5, and we didn't know that you couldn't just, like, you know, rip off some music and put it in a game, because we were both 16 or something. So I wrote out Equinox 5 and we put it in the game, and that was it, job done.
No rules, there was no formulas for actually getting this stuff done, and so we were all winging it. You know, we were all like just making it up as we went along. In some cases they would give me an example of what they wanted, and in some cases they wanted me to copy more or less the example that they gave me. So certain things like International Karate, they actually wanted that piece from Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence. That's what they asked for.
Playing with existing melodies doesn't have to be a constraint on your own creativity. When writing for the C64, they were springboards for wider experimentation. Really, Rob and Ben were remixing when they used well-known tunes. They added beats, played with arrangements, and wrote their own sections, always driven by testing the limits of the system and keeping players engaged.
Some of these things were predefined, but then I always tended to expand upon them, try to make it last a bit longer so that they didn't get quite so boring, because somebody's going to play these pieces of music on a title screen. It's going to loop for endlessly, and it's going to drive them nuts if it's not very interesting. So that's why a lot of times I would make 6 or 7 different sections to the music. Other games like Fear on a Spring, that came about just because of the subject matter, something that reflects that, what that thing on a spring is, really.
Repurposed melodies aside, Rob, Ben and their contemporaries put down far more of their own ideas. Thing on a Spring is a very early tune in Rob's catalogue, though Action Biker is usually stated to be his first piece. Even in his debut year composing VGM, Rob coded distinctive, iconic sounds that can send whole generations on a nostalgia trip, just like the impressive twang of Thing on a Spring. As Rob established himself, a young Ben Dalglish paid attention. Along with school friend Tony Crowther, Ben started out as something of a hobbyist himself. Rob's innovations were clearly audible, and when he consistently stretched the C64's capabilities in his work, serious fledgling programmers saw it as a challenge to accept.
I mean, I've been listening to Rob's stuff, obviously, since. Rob was kind of... It was listening to one of his pieces that originally spurred me and Tony to kind of start upping the game with the player and with the kind of the complexity of music that you could do. So the first couple of things that I'd done for Tony were just... he came along and asked me to write out some notes for him in a format that he could type into the computer using the player from the back of the C64 manual or something, you know. And so, the first couple of kind of things that he put out with music that I'd done was just that. And then we heard, it was Rob's arrangement of English Country Gardens, I think, was it? Or something like that. And so we went, bloody hell, you know, right, you can do all this. And so kind of Tony went away and started... like adding a load of routines to the player and turning it into something a bit more serious. And then I started playing around with it and making suggestions and working out exactly what you could do with it, purely inspired by the fact that Rob had got all these techniques that he was using to make it sound twice as good as anybody else's, you know.
Serendipitously, Ben would go from a fan of Rob's work to directly following it up for Thing Bounces Back, Thing on a Spring's sequel. Being well acquainted with Rob's work, Ben could take the original's core aspects and meld them with his own thoughts into a unique but faithful theme. That included melodic and tonal references, but Ben also tried his hand at his own spring sound, something that defined the first title.
Thing Bounces Back, it was, I was kind of already familiar with what he did. And yeah, it was the case of kind of just listening through a few times to the original and going, well, because I didn't want to rip it off. He was paying tribute, literally. So I'm thinking, right, so it'd be nice to put in some of the spring sounds. And actually, I can never completely duplicate his spring sound. I was never 100% sure how he did his. And I wasn't going to go poking around the code to find out, you know. So I got a reasonably good spring sound, I think. But it was never quite as good as his one. And then thought, okay, let's do the whole thing of just taking... like his original melody and making it sound like it's going to be a copy of the original. You know, it's a different piece, you know. I suppose the analysis of it was, what little bits of this can I use to show that it's a homage to the original, but not too much to have anybody accusing me of ripping it off, you know? So it was quoting it. It was nice to do it as part of the sort of the introduction to the piece, because then I use it and then I throw it away and carry on with what I'd done, you know.
Once his career had kicked off, Ben soon made his own name in the industry and took game-changing strides himself. C64 enthusiasts are known to name-drop Deflector when it comes to the best of his work. It has a catchy bassline, great sounds, and a truly classic feel, but most love it for Ben's honed cowbell. To create specific instrumentation like a cowbell took long bouts of experimentation, but success could provide the strong hook that good music needs. What tools were at the disposal of programmers to achieve that, and how did the process work?
I created the cowbell sound when I was just playing around with sounds and thought, oh yeah, I've got to write a piece around that. So yeah, with Deflector, the cowbell came first. Basically, it's waveforms and envelopes and filters. So you've got your set of waveforms, like your triangle and your sawtooth and square waves and stuff. A triangle wave is the nearest there was to a sine wave, kind of ooh, nice soft sound, you know. And then your sawtooth is a quite a buzzy thing, and square waves kind of depending on how on the width of the waveform. On top of that, you've got an envelope, which is the ADSR, they call it, the attack, decay, sustain, release, which is how fast the sound comes in. You know, a fast attack is up, and a slow attack is and then it decays a bit, and then the sustain is how long the note continues for, and then you've got release, which is how fast it comes out. So for a cowbell sound, obviously it's a very fast attack and a very fast decay. I'm pretty sure it was the triangle wave, because although it's a kind of, it's a harsh sound, although it's a heavy sound, it's not harsh, you see what I mean? And the cowbell doesn't go, it goes, top! And so, yeah, so having that, I think it was, it was that wah waveform. And I think there's probably a bit of white noise at the right at the beginning to give it a k sound. So it's a dop. Yeah, I think. I can't actually remember the specifics of it. But it's that kind of thing. So you play around with waveforms and with the enveloping and stuff, and then the filtering as well, which is all the, like, taking out different frequencies of the sound. And then eventually you get a cowbell.
Coming up with new, convincing sounds with the SID chip was a large part of the fun for Ben and Rob. Nobody could replicate Rob's thing on a spring, and Ben's cowbell was carefully sculpted from code and waves. Other instruments were a little easier to get right, like the flood of thick bass lines that set the pace for most C64 tunes. If you're a regular listener to this show, you'll know I like to talk bass wherever I can. It's my own favourite instrument, and the first I picked up. On the Commodore 64, bass came to the forefront for a number of reasons. It works efficiently with percussion, as we've already covered, has a punchy tone that suits SID chip music and the waves available, and finally, reflects much of the time's popular music.
There was a lot of it kind of happening in the 80s, kind of after Jaco had shown the way in the late 70s, and you got your Stanley Clarke and Bootsy and people like that. I think, yeah. So during the 80s, there was a lot of more prominent bass playing going around, I think. And I certainly picked up on that. I was a big Mark King fan. When I was thinking, oh, what should the bass line sound like, he certainly informed that for me. Jaco and stuff like that, but I didn't want to rip off Jaco. Well, it's movement, isn't it? You know, a lot of the games are about getting you moving, I suppose, and that's what bass and drums does. what you do on top in terms of melody and chords is kind of what makes the piece different and interesting, but in terms of what gives the style to the piece, it's definitely the bass and drums.
C64 music often drew from the charts and well-respected artists of the 80s. Now, the influence runs the other way. Core aspects and sounds from chip music have bled into popular music, though it took some time for that influence to come around. Personally, I hear some definite VGM shades in British electronic artists like Orbital and The Prodigy, who emerged in 1989 and 1990 respectively. Around a decade later, at the dawn of the 21st century, the effect of the home computer boom was easier to identify. The first generation of kids raised on video games in their own homes had grown up and taken the helm.
People used to say to me, oh, I only bought the games because your music was on it, things like that. And I thought, oh yeah, it's just, they're not being serious, you know, I never believed any of that. Game music, people really never regarded it as being very serious or very good. I kind of had a very strange regard for my own work in that respect. It wasn't until much later on that people had kind of shown a lot more respect for that stuff that I thought about it a lot more. And I'd recently been looking at some of the stuff that I did that I thought that a lot of it was a lot better than I remembered. And in that respect, you know, I have some kind of validation for the body of work that I did on a lot of the stuff.
Rob didn't have too many avenues for validation at the time. Without the internet, audience feedback was difficult to gather. Magazine reviews usually acted as the best place for criticism, but there was an element of composing in a vacuum. One exception was the demo scene that grew from the C64. A C64 demo was just that, a demonstration. But not of an upcoming game like we might assume today. Instead, these demos consisted of single images, animations, music, and anything else that might flaunt the abilities of both the programmer and the system. For users, they were compelling feats of computer skill. For the creatives behind them, they were an opportunity to go all out.
Beginning of the demo scene started with the C64, and that then kind of made things go off in a different direction as well, which is why you ended up with, for me, tunes like Sanction and Knuckle Busters and some of that later stuff, which was a little bit more adventurous, shall we say.
The demo scene was like an early version of file sharing. Users would swap demos around and spread them through word of mouth. Though some demos were hidden in games, it wasn't unusual for full disc demos to see release. Many C64 owners considered them just as much a reason to own a home computer as games and programming capabilities. Trap, a Tony Crowther game which hit the market in 1986, featured a demo that any from the scene would recognise. Also distributed on its own, or alongside other demos, probably without permission, Trap's hidden scene has been labelled Drum Man, Gladiator, The Real Cool Demo, and many more off-the-cuff names in its time. The game itself is a side-scrolling space shooter, with sound effects in place of music, but the hidden demo consists of a cinematic animation, scored by none other than Ben Dalglish, Tony Crowther's longtime friend.
In my head, I composed it as an orchestral piece, and then just worked out a way of being able to get it onto the SID. The game itself, in my head, demanded a grand orchestral score. When I was saying earlier about kind of you didn't get a lot of time to spend with the game, kind of quite often it'd just be you get a, you know, the phone call and whatever. That didn't apply, obviously, with the games that Tony was writing, because quite a lot of the time I was sitting in the same room as he was writing it. You know, I saw track from sort of beginning to end, as it were. I thought, God, it'd be really nice to have like a big, lush, you know, not quite sort of John Williams, but that kind of, yeah, big grand score for it. As well, we started doing this the demo at the end, you know, with the drummer and everything, you know, and about the time that I started writing the music, we thought, yes, okay, it'd be really nice to do this as a full kind of synced in with the music thing.
Trap's demo can be best described as a short film, designed for C64 hardware. It tells the story of alien contact, culminating in a battle or invasion, depending on your interpretation. All throughout, a somewhat ominous figure alternates between watching the action and beating a drum. The animation is impressive and dynamic, but Ben's music sets it apart. It has an orchestral feeling, a length approaching 10 minutes, and strong melodic content that swoops from section to section effortlessly. All the while, it slots right in with Tony Crowther's visuals, resulting in an essential experience for C64 users.
Some of the kind of the length and complexity came from, hey, let's make a movie, you know. There's the little quote from the Jeff Wayne chance of anything coming from Mars thing when he. They start landing and it switches into a bit of excitement here because the spaceship is and then kind of, you know, when the aliens say, oh, I don't know, you know, like it'd be really nice if we have like now a spaceship fly across here, I went, right, let's stick in some kind of type sounds. So yes, a lot of it was kind of designed to go along with the animation as well. As that got longer, the piece got longer, you know. But also, the whole what was driving was wanted to be best. Yeah, it's always the geek failing, as it were. It's always, you know, I want to be number one, and you know, half of the world's best technology now has come out of the fact that a geek has looked at something and go, I'd do better than that, you know.
That friendly competition fueled SID-chip composers. Getting complacent and lazy with your C64 music would quickly stick you out from the crowd, as every programmer sought to improve. That's why the era has so many classic themes, like Monty on the Run, The first half of the tune is made up of back-to-back melodic joy, but Rob Hubbard's outstanding guitar solo in the middle has given it legendary status. Obviously, there's no genuine guitar in Monty on the Run at all, but Rob pushed the available waveforms so close that it's always referred to as such.
I don't actually play guitar. Well, I suppose I do a little bit. I did dabble in a little bit in guitar when I was in my early teens, but I never played guitar very much at all. I've written for guitar, and I understand, I've heard enough guitar music to know the kind of riffs and styles that the people play. So a lot of the time I just try to emulate those kind of pitch bend effects and typical guitar rhythms. That was entirely just coded. You know, you hear it in your head and then, you know, work out a few things on manuscript paper, and it was all coded up. It's just down to experience, the fact that I've heard a lot of this stuff, and so much so that you can sing it, write it down, and then code it up.
There's an organic feeling to Monty on the Run's roaring guitar solo. That it was never even hashed out on a real guitar before conversion to code is stunning. As it progresses, it just gets better and more infectious. Oddly, genuine guitar covers never quite seem to do it justice, unable to capture Rob's perfect pitch bends. From analysing Rob's work for Thing Bounces Back, Ben Dalglish soon found himself working directly with his inspiration, this time for Auf Wiedersehen Monty. The sequel, which was actually the fourth in the series, was developed by Gremlin Graphics, a software company with both Ben and his old friend Tony Crowther on staff. They'd been in charge of Monty since his debut in Wanted, Monty Mole, and their connections with Rob and Ben helped bring them together.
It was a very easy process. Basically, he came down to the Gremlin offices. We spent whatever it was, 2-3 days just jamming, basically. He was sitting playing on the keyboards, I was sitting playing on guitar or another keyboard, and came up with some tunes and themes and fitted them together. Completely collaboratively, completely kind of just based on improvisation, and we'd go, oh, that's a good bit, and then one of us would add a bit to it, and another would go, not so sure, and, you know, we were getting pissed and just having a good time.
Ben and I actually worked very well, I thought. Ben is a very, he's a very talented musician. Very, very good flute player is Ben. And he has a very good ear. Like me, he tends to sing. He can sing better than me, but he tends to, like, sing things as well. We kind of bounced the ideas off each other, and it worked really well. It was a real good joint effort, and a bit prog rock, maybe, you know, which is, I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but that's just the direction that we kind of did things back then. But when we did the pitch bend solo thing in the middle of Auf Wiedersehen Monty, that was all Ben. He basically sang that, and I wrote it down and coded it all up.
And once we actually composed the piece, then Rob kicked me out of my own bloody office. He plugged it all into his player, because his player was I think better than mine at the time in terms of just efficiency and stuff, you know. So yeah, he took the tune that we'd done and plugged it into his player.
Auf Wiedersehen Monty followed up Rob's barnstorming solo with one of its own. The task was handed over largely to Ben, who brought some of his own techniques to the table. In no way is it simply a retelling of Rob's first solo either, ripping its way through quick licks and clever phrases.
Doing a guitar solo is a quite nice, cheap way of being able to get a load more music with very little extra data. The guitar solo, it's a single sound, and so all it is just the notes for the solo, a lot of which, again, you can repeat and mess around with and play in different speeds or whatever, but the backing for it can just keep staying the same for, you know, a good minute or so, you know. I think that the guitar solo's all mine, actually. Couldn't say for 100%, but I'm pretty sure I kind of originally did it on guitar. Not as fast and neat and smooth, obviously, because I'm a crap guitar player, but I seem to recall it, because I always wanted to try and do that whenever I did guitar solos. I played them on the guitar, because it's a different... playing guitar solo on a keyboard is a different thing. it sounds like a guitar, but doesn't necessarily have the same notes that a guitarist would do, you know, just to do with like where your fingers go. So I always try to do a lot of that in it.
Since the C64 could only evoke the tone and style of individual instruments without actually being able to play them, knowledge of their workings was important for authenticity. Default settings in manuals were known for producing sounds that barely approached their intentions, so it was up to the composers to build them anew. It's not enough to approximate an instrument texture either. You have to think about how it's played in reality, and what it's capable of pulling off.
I've tried to do that in my head, actually, with most instruments I write. I play most instruments, or I own most instruments. I don't know if I play them all particularly well, but I've got lots of instruments, and I've played kind of most of the groups, a bit of brass, a bit of wind, a bit of strings, that kind of thing, you know. Just because it's nice to have an idea of what a violinist does, you know, what a flute player does or something, when you're trying to write a flute part, you know. With something like Last Ninja, I think you're just being aware of the facts that there is a tradition for these instruments, if you see what I mean. And when you kind of listen to it, try and listen to it as these notes are being produced on this instrument because it's the kind of instrument that does this. Or sitar players, for instance, because you play the sitar with just your first two fingers. A lot of those runs that you get, it's informed by the fact that it's just the two fingers happening rather than the five fingers on the guitar. You know, but not four fingers, you don't use your thumb on your right hand often, on your left hand often, yeah. It helps knowing what real instruments are like and how they produce sound and what the sort of the mechanics of them are.
With so much for C64 musicians to consider, mistakes and bugs were sure to appear. Traditionally, a program called a debugger is used to test for any potential hiccups. The Commodore 64 didn't always have that luxury, so composers would have to improvise. Interesting methods of working without a debugger quickly surfaced, and some were quite ingenious.
When I worked on the Amiga, I didn't have any debugger at all. That was quite frustrating, trying to write the code without a debugger, when it was my first steppings into 68,000 code. But what you do is you tend to try to write a small module, and you can sprinkle the code with little things that can maybe change a colour on the screen, something of that nature, so that you know where the code has got to here. If this happens, you know, you might change the background colour or something like that, so that if the code reaches this point under certain circumstances, you change the black background colour to blue. If the code reaches this other point and something has happened that you didn't expect, you change it to red. And that way, you know, if something like that happens, you can, you know, draw some conclusions as to what went on in the code. The other thing is that when you haven't got a debugger, you have to write code in very small modules. You don't try to write the whole thing in one go. You write little small modules and get them to work, and then build it up. certain extent, it was all part of a learning process, you know, because there really wasn't many good tools around, development tools, which would allow you to debug things. The assembler on the C64 had a machine code monitor, so you could display 8 bytes on a line, maybe 16 lines of by 8 bytes or something like that, and you could change the value of those bytes in real time. I understood the data format of the music that well, and I could edit those bytes in real time to change certain parameters of the music or the sound parameters. But the code was pretty much debugged by that other method. When I got to EA, they had proper development systems, like Sega Genesis and all those kinds of machines. They always developed pretty sophisticated tools to let you debug everything.
Having to personally debug things was only really a problem in the 80s, eventually disappearing as powerful consoles took over the home gaming market. But, at the time, it was another job to add to an imposing list. Composers of the period constantly battled the medium on the technical side, while also needing to write the tunes as well. On top of that, sound effects had to be taken care of.
Bored me stiff, personally. It was always just, oh, fucking hell, got to do the sound effects now, having written music. If you could, a great thing was to be able to reuse your instruments and your sound effects. So, you know, if you've got a drum sound, then that works as well as for a crashing into a wall sound or whatever, you know.
Mirroring musical instruments in the effects is a clever way to get around one big problem, the three-voice limit of the SID chip. Because of that limit, a decision had to be made on every game. Should the music use all three voices and cut one whenever a sound effect plays? Or instead, would it be better to compose strictly on two, leaving the third permanently free for noises like explosions and gunshots? When playing certain C64 games, it can be very distracting for a whole third of the music to disappear every few seconds. This can be heard right up to the mid-90s too, like when you collect a ring on Sonic the Hedgehog. Equally, music chained to a mere two voices loses a lot of depth, something users had come to expect from the SID chip.
Sometimes it would be you'd say, right, this voice you can take out anytime. You know, so like generally, I don't know, if you've got a three-voice piece that's got the bass and drums on one voice, melody on another, and chords on the third, you could say, well, you can drop out the melody. So with the bass, drums and chords keeping the music going on, whenever you need to play a sound effect, just take out that top voice, play the sound effect, and then switch back to the melody voice, say. But then sometimes they'd want the full bollocks three-voice sound effects, so everything had to cut out. Or, yeah, with some games, they just sort of went for the easy option, which is, do you want music or do you want sound effects, you know? Again, just because of the limitations of the chip, you know? Programmer would decide how much priority they want to give the sound effects.
I think a lot of the times in those early games it was a question of either you play the game with sound effects or you play the game with the music. But we did sometimes do music using just two voices, which would leave the third voice free for sound effects. That kind of worked to a limited extent. To me, it seemed better to either play it with music or play it with sound effects, because one tends to get in the way of the other, especially when, you know, you've only got a primitive sound chip. I mean, obviously, today's PlayStation is a bit different to that. You know, you get full quality sound effects and music. But sound effects on those early chips was quite difficult. You had to just accept the fact that the only thing you could come up with was going to be pretty daft, pretty bad. So you just had to bite the bullet and basically say, well, this is the best I can do. It doesn't really sound like what it's supposed to, but it's the best I'm going to get out of this.
The effects you hear in modern games are likely, with some exceptions, genuine samples or recordings made by dedicated Foley artists. On the C64, the craft of sound effects was similar to that of single instruments, involving choosing the right wave and applying ADSR. The results often implied a certain sound by emulating its properties, leaving the rest to the player's imagination. Compared to some other chips, the SID's effects were sophisticated, but getting them right took significant effort.
Getting them good is really hard. Sound effect, say it was boring, it was, but it was also hard to get them good. That involves a hell of a lot more pissing around with all those parameter things I was talking about in order to be able to find it. You know, a good explosion is just, you know, you've got a standard explosion, which is, again, you just take some white noise and you go.
I mean, trying to do sound effects on an AY chip, or even worse, the IBM PC speaker, which was just a beep, was just ridiculously stupid. You just had to knuckle down and get on with it. The IBM platform was actually a nightmare because of all the different configurations. You had the MC32, the Adlib, the Tandy was another variation, and the PC speaker, so it was like doing 4 or 5 projects all at the same time.
In the face of all the difficulties that challenged Rob, Ben, and others like them, C64 music has endured. Sure, 80s kids still play it and return to the days of their youth, but it gains new fans all the time. Be it through chiptune or the influence we hear in popular bands and artists, the three-voice simplicity of the system's sounds remains appreciated. A few months from the release of this podcast, the Hull Philharmonic Orchestra are set to perform a host of C64 tunes, featuring key works from both Rob and Ben. Bearing in mind the toil required with the SID chip, why did new generations continue to mimic its techniques?
There's a book coming out by Kenny McAlpine about chiptunes. He's a professor and he is extremely bright, he touches upon that very thought that you just mentioned. People are, for some reason now, drawn into the chiptune phenomena, as it were, going back to 8-bit sound chips. I asked him about that specifically, because I said, why would anybody want to go back to being interested in 8-bit chiptunes when you've got, you know, modern PCs with extremely sophisticated programs that can produce things that are infinitely more better than what a chip can produce? And he said that it's a question of choice. If you've got too much choice, people find it hard to make decisions. It's overwhelming when you've got all these VST plugins and different kinds of effects that you can put on different instruments using Cubase or whatever. But when you go back to an 8-bit sound chip, like a SID chip or an AY chip, people find that a lack of choice gives them some kind of inspiration in another direction. So it's almost like you're focusing your imagination or your creativity, not in being distracted by the infinite choice, but by focusing on the limitations of what's available.
One of the last chips that attracted Rob was the OPN2 FM chip, which he regularly came into contact with after taking an in-house role at Electronic Arts. This FM chip was utilised in Sega's beloved Genesis, or Mega Drive, and was responsible for the console's unique, edgy, and downright cool sounds. In his final stretch composing, and before Infinite Choice took the fun out of it for him, Rob enjoyed working with the OPN2, audibly so in the glorious Monty-esque guitars of Road Rash 1 and 2.
Compared to an AY chip and compared to some of the Tandy chip and the PC speaker, it was breath of fresh air. And the fact that it was just one configuration on the Sega Genesis, one set of hardware, they got a complete Z80 in the sample channel. It was just so much better than the Adlib as well. I think it was 4 operators on the FM chip on the Sega. Like I said, a breath of fresh air from everything else that had been going on. And don't forget, I think before that we'd been working on the that 8-bit Nintendo box.
The Nintendo Entertainment System, or NES, was generally disliked by composers, seen as behind the times and clunky. That's a surprise to hear, since so many classics have come from the machine. Not least from David Wise, who you can hear talk about NES music in the previous Donkey Kong episode of this series. Taken aback by Rob's perspective, I asked how a chip that first produced Koji Kondo's Mario theme could be looked down on.
The 8-bit Nintendo was just I can't remember what chip it had, but it was just a very limited chip for its time. It comes out like 6 years later and comes out with a chip that's like totally inferior to what a SID chip is. That's my question with these things. Atari ST came out, 87, you know, and that had like a totally inferior chip to the SID chip. they do all these great strides to improve the graphics, and then like take steps back with the audio. That doesn't make any sense to me.
Nothing quite grabbed Rob or Ben Daglish with the same intensity as the SID chip, though there was still some fun to be had with Sega's FM chip. The climate changed and broadened. Some state the death knell as the Amiga and its use of samples. Rob had managed to play lo-fi guitar samples on the C64's Skate or Die, an unbelievable achievement, but it took a lot of knowledgeable exploitation of the SID. The Amiga made it easy, as some might argue, too easy.
It was the first step towards the way that it goes now, which is, you know, you go into a recording studio and you record an orchestra. And that's it, you know. It didn't involve any chip programming. All it involved was just the sequencing of the music itself. Part of the problem was that because you're still reasonably limited with memory, I mean, obviously it was a lot more than the 64, but samples take up a lot more space. You either have shitty recorded samples at, you know, 11k or 5k or something, or you have nice sounding samples, but each one is 200k of memory.
Although they were lo-fi, a sample is still a sample. Rather than making the most of a few constrained waves, a sample is a real recording of a real instrument. Even if you compress that recording to high heaven, the difference between samples and SID chip synthesis is clear to any set of ears. Yet, they brought their own set of problems. Nowadays, electronic keyboards can use samples of every separate note of a piano, for example. An Amiga would never be able to hold that much information, so a single recording of one note would have to be pitch shifted to compensate. That aspect alone could slow things down considerably, so it's fair to question if the earliest days of VGM sampling were worth it. For my two cents, they were an integral step in a direction that's proved more than fruitful, but it isn't hard to see why SID musicians like Rob and Ben found the practice frustrating.
You still had limitations in the number of sounds that you could put together and sequence and stuff, but then you couldn't really do a lot with the sounds themselves. You just had the samples that you'd recorded, and that was it. You could play them back at different speeds and to get your different notes. And even then, it never sounded right because you never had the space to be able to record really different samples for each instrument, which you need because the sound of the bottom E string on a bass is completely sound different, really, to the sound of your G string up on the 12th fret or something. Five years later, like, people had worked out loads of techniques to be able to get it going a lot better. The chip programming stuff was half of the fun. Messing around with, like I said, with different parameters, different waveforms and envelopes and stuff to create different sounds, yeah.
By the release of the first PlayStation, sampling was the norm and used to better effect. It was often married with MIDI, which grew into a universal force we still hear everywhere. Thanks to the snowballing complexity of technology, games soon featured more and more ambitious soundtracks. Synthesizing a full orchestra became possible, then obsolete just as quick, once full quality recordings took over. How much has VGM's history since the 80s followed a predictable pattern? Did Rob Hubbard, who was practically there from the beginning, see any of what we know today on the horizon?
Well, there's a thing they call, was it Moore's Law, where the processing doubles every, what is it, 2 years or something? Or is it every year or something like that? Initially, we didn't know where this was going to lead to, especially with the games, because, well, I thought that the games were just a small fashion, if you like, a small period which would people would be into, and then somebody else would take over. I thought that the computers would inevitably end up with serious applications and education, not any of the game stuff, but that was completely wrong. By the time we got through to 88, the Amiga had come out, it was pretty obvious what was going to be happening. This stuff was just going to grow exponentially in terms of the computing power and memory and everything.
Another thing that changed the face of VGM, and as a direct result of samples, is licensing music. This is when existing songs from well-known bands or artists are used in games for a fee. Ironically, licensing turned the tables. Established melodies have been played in games for years, as we've already covered in this podcast, but largely as homages that meld with original music. When licensing came along, sports games in particular had a field day. The Tony Hawk's Pro Skater series, to name but one, has a soundtrack made up entirely of popular songs. With so many talented composers ready and willing to fill our games with brand new music, I wondered why Rob thinks licensing was so common by the mid-90s.
The business changed because of the money. People are risking a lot of money to do a game. They've got to be pretty sure that the game's going to sell. So the marketing people do everything possible to try to get something that's going to sell. That's why they went on this route to licensing music, because they think that might add value to the sales. People who grew up with the older stuff, they don't, you know, they seem to reject it. But, you know, it's the marketing people say, well, this is what the majority of people want, this is going to help with the sales, especially when they've spent, you know, 2 or 3 years in development and a few million dollars making this game. They're going to want the return.
Because of these developments, Rob retired from composing VGM following his stint at Electronic Arts in 1996. It's a shame we had to lose such musical wellsprings as Rob and Ben Daglish to the ever-rolling tides of invention. Both felt alienated by the industry's direction, but neither stopped championing the hard work of SID-chip composers. Along with live performances, remix albums, and a string of fascinating interviews, They've given lectures and appeared in documentaries whenever they can. So, from Rob's perspective of love for the days of the C64, how does the industry look and sound to him now?
You notice that all the games now are all, like, basically very similar. They're all, like, first-person shooters. Most of them are some variation on that. It's very safe for them to do those kind of games. And also the sports games like your FIFA soccer and John Madden football and all the rest of these things. It's very safe for them to do them because they know that they're going to produce X amount of sales. And so that automatically limits the direction that you can go in with any other aspects of game design or music. A lot of the games have, in some ways, have followed the pattern of the movies, so they want, like, something that sounds like Hans Zimmer, because that's what they expect on a movie, and, you know, they don't want some of the more abstract creativity that used to happen.
As the host of a podcast that covers the whole scope of VGM, it would be cowardly of me to agree with every word of those final thoughts from Rob. However, he does have a point. Nobody would argue more passionately than me that VGM is as strong as it's ever been. But there's a certain contingency of AAA games that play it safe and follow set formulas. Perhaps that's just because the medium is so much more widespread, and therefore diluted, in 2018. Back on the C64, almost everything burst with character. The music, an afterthought to the developers, gripped users because the minds behind it were never deterred by the myriad shackles chaining their vision. They turned those shackles into an ordered, guiding path to technical feats that remain unbelievable. After hearing the tragic news of Ben Daglish's passing during the production of this episode, I immediately decided to close with his insight. Not only did Ben give us truly top-tier Sid music to enjoy, but he was a beloved and friendly soul who always welcomed his fans. I was extremely nervous to speak to him myself, but I only needed a minute in his company to relax. I was devastated to learn he'd left us, but I hope his final words in this podcast can help people remember two important things about Ben Daglish. He was a funny, good-natured, and highly intelligent man, and his work on the Commodore 64 was in a league of its own. All fans of C64 music associate the same game with Ben. We all have our individual favourites, but none deny The Last Ninja. Its soundtrack is gigantic for its time, verging on a whole hour of loader tunes and level tracks by Ben and Anthony Lees. The Last Ninja is held in such high regard that constant questions about it, comically, started to grate on its composers.
A bit like an AA meeting, isn't it? My name is Ben. I wrote The Last Ninja. There's not a lot to tell about The Last Ninja. The only interesting thing, I suppose, about the process was, I think, the fact that it was a particular combination of I would like to write some really nice oriental stuff, but with a really good sort of rock feel to it. And I was, by the time I wrote it, quite experienced in the whole art of writing music for the SID. And it all, I wrote it all quite quickly, as I say, in about a week or something. So it all flowed nicely. It all came together nicely. There were no struggles with it. It was one of those things that once I started writing it, it all just came out. I did it kind of all in my head as well, which is kind of always the best way of writing if you can, rather than kind of sitting at an instrument and doing it, because then you're limited by what you can do on that instrument, really. It all just came out of my head really nice. And then the process of putting it together was just extremely short and very simple. I went down to Brighton for the day, down to Mark Hale's house, and we plugged it into the game, and I went away again. The game itself is really well done. I mean, there was a lot of time spent on it. A lot of people involved in various ways, I believe. But yes, it was a good work of art. It was quite innovative in many ways. Lots of music as well. I mean, that's the only unusual thing, was I think it was probably the first time that I've been asked to write whatever it was, 10 pieces of music or something, and then you've got all the music that Anthony wrote as well. Mark had commissioned kind of, you know, music and game in level music for whatever it was, 10 levels, you know. So it was a lot of music to go in a game. That's pretty much it, other than if you want to include the famous story about him offering me a second and left-hand drive BMW, and I said no thanks, I'll take the money. That's pretty much it, you know. So yes, I think it's just one of those serendipity things, you know, that it just happened that the game was really good, the music I was quite proud of and fitted well with the game, and lots of people have nice, happy memories about it.
Thanks to Ben Dalgleish for speaking to me for the sound test. I hope this episode lives up to his legacy and maybe even make some new fans. I'm also extremely grateful for Rob Hubbard agreeing to appear on this show, and to you for taking the time to listen. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, please make sure to subscribe or follow on whatever platform you might be listening on. There will be a new episode each week, though we are nearing the end of this 16-episode series. Next week, Danny Baranowski makes his final sound test appearance in an edition looking at his original soundtrack for Super Meat Boy. Finally, I'd like to pay one last tribute to Ben by playing the Last Ninja's Wastelands theme in full. We just heard a beautiful classical guitar arrangement from Jamie Maxwell, but I couldn't let this episode end without its C64 original. To quote Ben's friend, Chris Abbott, "The world needs more like Ben Dalgleish, not less."